Title of this tape is Key Moments, or What Happens When Things Go Wrong. And my purpose is to talk about what it is that is going on when things aren't going well and what we can do to correct that. In order to understand that, I'd like to talk for a moment about the concept of awareness. Awareness is critical. It has to do with noticing or seeing what's going on around me. It has to do with being real and honest about where I am. As a matter of fact, I believe that awareness is the gateway to change, that change occurs out of increased awareness. Let me give you a couple of examples of that. Let's assume that I want to travel to New York City. What do I need to know? Obviously, I need to know where New York City is. I need to know my means of transportation, who my companions will be, the resources that I have. But I also need to know where I'm starting from. The only way I can get from Denver to New York City is by knowing that I'm in Denver. Because if I assume that I'm in, let's say, Boston, but I'm really in Denver, then I'm going to end up somewhere down in southwestern Colorado. It's always necessary to know where I'm starting from to get to another destination. That's what I mean when I talk about awareness. Awareness is knowing where I am. It's seeing what's happening around me. Let me give you another example of that. When I find myself in a new mall, sometimes being in a new mall can be an overwhelming experience. One of the things that's most helpful is to find the directory. At each entrance is a directory, and the directory has the different levels of the mall and the different stores listed and then indicated in different colors and numbers and so on. What's most helpful about that directory is the sign, the arrow that says, "You are here." In order for me to get where I want to go, it's necessary for me to know exactly where I am. And that's what awareness is all about. Awareness is being able to see what is really going on, what is happening in my life. As a matter of fact, I'm a victim of whatever I'm unaware of. For example, if I have a smudge on my face, but I don't know that I have a smudge, then I don't have any choices about it. There's nothing that I can do to correct the problem. Or if I'm angry, but I don't know that I'm angry, or I act like I'm not angry, then I can't give myself any new choices to correct the anger. If I have a problem with drinking, but I don't let myself know, I deny that I have a problem with drinking, then I can't do anything to correct the problem. So awareness has to do with telling myself the truth about where I am. It's being real. It's being honest. It's seeing things the way they are, seeing what's going on around me. The philosopher Krishnamurti talks about the importance of awareness when he says, "One must know oneself as one is, not as one wishes to be, which is merely an ideal, and therefore fictitious, unreal. It is only that which is real that can be transformed, not that which you wish to be. The understanding of what you are without distortion is the beginning of virtue." And I would add, the beginning of change, the beginning of transformation. One of the most helpful concepts, I believe, in expanding my awareness is that of a key moment. A key moment is when things are not working. So by understanding a key moment, by becoming aware of my key moments in life and changing how I respond, that is, giving myself new choices, I'm able to eliminate the problem areas, the areas that aren't working, and have my life run much more smoothly. Let me define key moment for you. A key moment is a moment of upset when I make a choice about how I'll respond. The key word is upset. That is, it's a moment when I feel some intense negative emotion. And at that moment, when I feel upset, I make a choice about how to respond to what's happening. And the choice that I make depends on how aware I am. If I'm unaware or unconscious, then it's easy for me to get cycled into pre-programmed, negative, self-defeating behavior. But if I'm aware, if I know what's happening, then it's an opportunity to make some choices that are going to be in my best long-term self-interest. Let me give you a few examples of key moments. Key moments can include children bickering at the dinner table, or a driver cuts in front of me as I'm traveling down the highway, or I overhear somebody making a critical remark about me behind my back, or my spouse confronts me on something that I promised to do but haven't yet done, or maybe my spouse and I are disagreeing about finances, or disagreeing about discipline of the kids, or negative feedback that I've gotten from my boss about a project that I'm working on. It's any moment when I feel upset. I'd like you to consider your key moments, the moments in which you feel upset. What are some of your most prominent key moments in your intimate relationships with your spouse, with your children, maybe with your parents, on the job, socially? What are those moments when you're most upset? I like to think of a key moment as akin to being in my cess. All of us know what a cesspool is. I recently read a book called The City of Joy by Dominique Lapierre, a French author. The book is the story of a slum in the city of Calcutta. And he describes that during monsoon season, the rains would begin to pour, and sometimes it would rain for hours or even days. These people did not have private bathroom facilities. They didn't have good sewage and drainage systems, so the water in the streets would begin to back up. And after hours of intense rain, the water could be so deep that the people would literally be slogging through the streets, waist deep, sometimes shoulder deep, in human waste. They would literally live for a couple of weeks during the monsoon season in a cesspool. Now, I know none of us have experienced those kinds of conditions, but I like to think of key moments as akin to being in my cess psychologically. Sometimes I'm in my cess ankle deep, sometimes 1 foot, sometimes 3 feet. I might be up to my neck. Sometimes I might be sucking air through a straw. There are two rules that are important to understand about being in cess. One is that I am the only one who can put me in. And two, I'm the only one who can get me out. If you can internalize the meaning and importance of those rules, it will be critical to you. Because most of us believe when we're in our cess that somebody else put us there. And we also believe that it's somebody else's job to get us out. Let me give you some examples of what I mean by that. If I'm seated at the dinner table and my kids are bickering and I get upset, who do I think is the cause of me being upset? I think the reason that I'm upset is that my kids are bickering. They put me in my cess. Or if my spouse is being critical of me or not being sensitive to me and my feelings are hurt and I'm retreating and withdrawing and pouting, again, I'm in my cess. I think the reason I'm in my cess is because my spouse isn't being as supportive as I would like. Or I was expecting an important phone call from a friend, and the friend didn't call. I'm feeling ignored. I'm feeling put down. Again, I believe the reason that I'm feeling upset is because my friend didn't call. So it's easy for us in our day-to-day lives, when we lack awareness about what is happening, to believe that other people are responsible for our key moments, or to believe that other people put us in our cess. Not only do I believe other people put me in, but I also live with the fantasy or the belief that other people must get me out, that I could get out of my cess if my kids would just behave and be polite. If my friend would apologize for not calling, I could get out of my cess. If my spouse would treat me different, would be more sensitive to me and my needs, then I would no longer need to be in my cess. And when people don't respond and behave the way I would like, what I tend to do is I tend to splash around, I tend to make noise, I tend to create lots of drama. That is, I tend to suffer. I suffer as a way of letting people know that I'm unhappy, as a way of letting people know that things aren't working and that they need to change and treat me differently in order for me to be happy. The paradox is that I make myself miserable to get other people to see what they've done or to treat me differently. The only way I can get them to get it, how they're mistreating me and how they need to change their behavior, is by making myself all the more miserable and all the more unhappy. Most of the time, I'm not even consciously aware that this is happening. It's all unconscious processes. but an indication of just how responsible I'm making other people for my life and how dependent I am on them being different are the number of key moments I have. The more key moments I have and experiences I go through life, the more I've given up responsibility for being in my cess and for getting myself out of my cess. Now, I'd like to share a related concept. I've been talking about making other people responsible for me being in my cess. A related concept is that of codependency. And codependency is when I believe that I'm responsible for somebody else being in their cess. I think that it's either my fault that they're struggling, that they're upset, that they're having problems, or I think that I need to do something to fix them, to take care of it, to make their problems go away. Let me share an example of this. I recall this summer my daughter, 11-year-old daughter, was working on a 4-H project. She was sewing a blouse, and it was really a project that was pretty difficult. And she's a very responsible and a very capable, conscientious person. In fact, I think that was part of the problem. She tends to be so conscientious and responsible that she is a bit of a perfectionist and wants to do things just so. Well, she was having difficulty with this project and making a little bit of headway and a little bit of progress, working on it every day. But as the deadline approached that it was to be completed, she was not done. And I remember the night before it was to be finished, I was not home. She and my wife were at home, and my wife had been very patient and working with her through all of this. And Melinda got upset. She recognized that she didn't have time to complete the project, and she just got very frustrated and very upset. My wife decided to jump in her cess. She started saying things to her like, "Melinda, why have you been putting it off and not working on it faster? And I've been telling you that you needed to do more earlier in the summer." And Melinda's upset triggered Judy's upset. Instead of Judy being able to allow Melinda to be upset and support her in being upset, she jumped in her cess also. Then I came home, and Judy told me the story, everything that had been going on, and I jumped in my cess. And my reaction was, well, she should have been working on it earlier during the entire summer, not putting it off to the last minute, and she needs support, and why is it that leaders give projects that are so difficult? And I've heard other parents complaining about this same project. And I jumped in my cess. It's as though when somebody else is upset, out of my loyalty, my love, my concern, my over-responsibility to them, I also need to be upset. And that's the meaning of codependency. Or if I'm not upset, I think that I need to fix them. I need to take care of them. I need to somehow correct the problem for them so that it will go away. So I invite you to consider for a moment when you jump in your cess and who you have been telling yourself makes you jump in your cess, and who you have been hoping or wishing would change their behavior so that you could no longer be in that cess. And I want you to know that it's not wrong and you're not bad for being in your cess. It really is part of the human condition. All of us spend time in our cesspools. I'd like you also to consider who you have tried to rescue from their cess. Are there times in your life when you have believed you were at fault for another person being in their cess, or that you needed to fix or rescue them or take care of them in some way in order for them to get out? Now, what I'd like to do is talk about a key moment in a little more depth, a little more detail, so that you can understand everything that's happening when in a key moment and when you're tempted to jump into your cess. There are four different internal reactions that occur inside of me when I'm in a key moment. That is, each time I'm in a key moment, these are the different dynamics that are going on inside of me. One, There are physical sensations that always accompany a key moment. Let me share with you some examples of physical sensations. They include such things as sweaty palms, rapid heartbeat, shortness of breath, flushed, tension in different parts of the body, that is muscle tension in my legs, in my back, in my shoulders, in my head, headache, nausea, tight jaw. Those are all examples of physical sensations or physical reactions that I can have during a key moment. And every time I'm in a key moment, I will experience some physical sensations. And when I'm not able to resolve my key moments or when I have chronic key moments, eventually, physiologically, my systems begin to break down, and that's when disease and illness set in. A second aspect or internal reaction that I have to a key moment are feelings. Feelings or emotions. And they include such things as anger, fear, anxiety, frustration, resentment, loneliness, embarrassment, hopelessness, sense of shame, inadequacy, worthlessness, depression, hurt, rejection, guilt. I could go on and on. But there are always feelings that accompany a key moment. A third internal aspect of a key moment are memories or fantasies. That is, my mind will consciously or unconsciously tap into similar experiences that I've had in the past, incidents that are even remotely similar to the experience that I'm having currently. Or I'll have negative fantasies, I like to call them dark fantasies, about the future, about what could possibly happen. So memories and fantasies also accompany a key moment. And oftentimes the memories and fantasies occur so quickly, so spontaneously and automatically, I'm not even aware of having them or of where they come from. A final internal reaction to a key moment are thoughts. Inevitably, when I have a key moment, there are thoughts that I have which are negative and self-defeating. To borrow a term from Ron Smotherman, I like to call this mind stuff. Mind stuff are those negative self-defeating thoughts and beliefs that I have about myself, about the world, about other people, about situations. Negative thoughts will inevitably accompany a key moment. As a matter of fact, it is the thoughts, the mind stuff, that is responsible for the rest of my reaction to a key moment. It is not the event itself that results in the key moment, but it's the mind stuff that I have about the event. It's all of the negative and self-defeating thinking that I do that results in the trauma of the key moment. Let me give you an example. Suppose I were to step on your foot. If I were to step on your foot and you believe that it were purely accidental, that I didn't mean to, you'd likely feel very little, maybe neutral, or very mild irritation. But on the other hand, if you believe that I stepped on your foot out of provocation, that I wanted to hurt you or be mean to you, then certainly your reaction would be much stronger. So it's not the event, it's not the incident per se that is critical during a key moment, but rather it's the mind stuff. It's the way I talk to myself and the way I think about what is happening. Let me give you another example. Let's suppose a guy calls a girl up and asks her out on a date. And she has a very, very lame excuse about why she won't go out with him this coming Friday night. A refusal, the words no, or the words I can't go out with you, inherently don't cause the internal reaction of depression or hurt or embarrassment that he might be feeling. If he's experiencing those feelings, the reason he's doing so is because of the way he's talking to himself about the event. He's saying, she doesn't like me, girls don't like me, I've never been able to be very successful with girls, I don't know if I ever will, I'll probably spend a lot of time alone in my life. It's the talk that he does, the mind stuff, all of the thinking, the negative thinking that has been programmed in him since childhood that's responsible for his reaction to that situation. So the thoughts that I have are very critical to the way I react in a key moment. So we've talked about the four internal reactions to a key moment, and inevitably these reactions will accompany all of my key moments. I will always have physical sensations, whether I'm aware of them or not. I will have emotions, whether I'm aware of them or not, memories or fantasies associated with my key moments, and negative thinking or mind stuff. It's important to become aware not only of the incidents that trigger my key moments, the actions that are going on during a key moment, if I'm to find more healthy ways of resolving them. Not only do we react internally to a key moment, but we also react externally. I'd like to talk for just a minute about what I do when I experience a key moment, the behaviors from my key moments. What I tend to do is create drama. There are three types of drama that I can create in my life. One type is fighting, and various forms of fighting. Another is running, and different forms of running. And a third is ignoring, and different forms of ignoring. Let me share with you some of the typical ways that we fight, or run, or ignore. And I want to remind you that these are not healthy responses to a key moment. There are other alternatives rather than fighting, running, and ignoring. This is what we tend to do when we lack awareness, when we're unconscious, when we're not in control of what's happening to us during that key moment. Some of the ways that we fight: we put other people down, we yell and argue, we find fault, we blame, we defend, use verbal abuse, foul language, slam things, throw things, manipulate, intimidate, use sarcasm, gossip. Those are all ways of fighting when I'm experiencing a key moment. It reminds me a little bit of a scene from the movie American Graffiti, when a kid pulled up to the red light, put his car in reverse, and then when the light changed, forgot to switch to drive, hit the gas pedal, and ran into the car behind him. He immediately jumped out of his car, ran back, and started yelling at the man behind him for being so stupid as to run into him. That's a good example of a fighter. Fighters don't like to be wrong. They don't like to lose or see their part in what's happening. Instead, they tend to go on the attack. They tend to go on the offensive and make other people wrong for what's happening. The bottom line of fighting is attacking. It's protecting myself and manipulating other people by attacking. The message that I send is, big me, little you. I'm okay, you're not okay. You'd better do what I want around here, or there will be heck to pay. Or a second form of reacting to a key moment is that of running. Some examples of running include being a martyr, pouting, using the silent treatment, illness, appeasing or placating other people, being apologetic, abdicating, being willing to take the blame. I remember in a class that I was teaching once, there was a woman in her late 30s still living at home. And every time she talked about moving out, and she was certainly capable enough of living on her own, but every time she talked about moving away, her father, who was somewhat ill, began to have chest pains and physical symptoms. And the daughter, out of loyalty, stayed to take care of him, unconscious of what was really happening and how manipulative he was being. But that's a form of running. Running is withdrawing, retreating, shutting down. Running is being more indirect than fighting. Fighters come out very directly and attack and put down and put people on the defensive. Runners, on the other hand, have a tendency to be weak and to be helpless and to be incapable and get other people to take care of them. A third way that we commonly do our dramas is by ignoring. Ignorers are people who deny or pretend that problems really don't exist. These are people who don't like conflict a lot and will do anything that they can to avoid it. So they deny the feelings and the emotions involved in human relationships. Some typical forms of ignoring include suppressing and not allowing myself to feel feelings, being very rational and intellectual about everything, business as usual, dismissing or discounting the importance of an issue, sometimes using humor when tension gets high to alleviate the stress, or distracting people from the problem that's going on. A lot of the addictions tend to be ways of ignoring. And when I talk about the addictions, I mean alcohol and drugs, but I also mean work can be a way of ignoring. Television, food, sex can all be ways of ignoring. A classic ignorer was a friend of mine who used to say about everything, "It's no biggie, it's no biggie." That was the way he had learned to respond to life. Now, I believe that some fighters and runners could use a good, healthy dose of "it's no biggie," because they tend to make a big thing out of everything. But for him, it was his way of denying that problems existed in his life. His wife could be upset with him, and he'd say, "It's no biggie." She could be packing the kids in the car and getting ready to drive away. His kids would be crying and saying, "Dad, when will we see you again?" And his response would be, "It's no biggie." He had been hurt in his life, and his way to deal with that hurt was really to deny it, to not even let himself know that he hurt.